Welcome to the Agile Wire, where professional Scrum trainers Jeff Bubbles and Jeff Molesky discuss Agile topics. Now, here are your hosts, Jeff Bubbles and Jeff Molesky.
And we are recording. All right, Mr. Bubbles, kick us off, man.
All right, so part two of our chat with John Kern here. So we just wanted more time with John. John had so many good things to say last time. We had such a good discussion going. So John, I think we were talking last time right around the agile mindset. And maybe sometimes it's easier to say, what isn't the agile mindset? And so how do you describe that? Like sometimes describing the negative of something helps you figure out what the positive is.
Interesting. Yeah, that's true. For me, it's, I'm going to start with a positive. I'm sure I'll come up with the negatives because those are fun. I think it's the missing piece for me personally that one of my colleagues, John Turley, who's kind of reset his career back in 2016 from being a classic project management type person and then realizing something was missing and, you know, why does sometimes things work? And it's kind of the same feeling I have. I can say the same thing, different team, different time, different result. And like, huh. What was different? I don't get it. Why is that? Mm-hmm. And he went on a journey to learn more about kind of the people and culture side, digging in deeper. So we all talk about it, right? Oh yeah, people. Oh yeah. You know, I've been saying people, process, and tools in that order for 20 freaking years. Mm-hmm. And finally, I think there's a little more meat on the bones or more depth to that discussion. And the kind of the way that it started to unlock for me was learning that it's not so much what you say. Like if you, like I said, I thought I was saying the same thing to different people, you know, different people, I get different results. And yeah, no kidding. You know, and he helped me understand that part of it is understanding the mindset of the recipient is also just as important. And there's kind of I'm actually doing a many week long course, which is why I was up at 4:30 this morning for a 5 a.m. UK 4-hour class that we're studying leadership development framework and kind of the developmental journey that humans take. So it's a really fascinating view. And this is stuff that John Turley had really turned me on to. And so I wanted to learn more. And he said, well, let's, you know, go to the source here. And if you're trying to communicate something that's maybe two steps too far in front of someone's own developmental journey, it's like, you know, knock, knock, knock. Is this thing on? You know, no, it's not. Just, yeah. And so, you know, it would take me longer to get that, you know, the feedback to recognize, oh, huh, yeah, no, it really didn't land. They really didn't get it. And in a similar vein, we do some research with our clients and do like what's called a motivational orientation survey. So, mm-hmm. It's kind of, how do you respond to cues? Do you respond, you know, autonomously or more in a, you know, command and control style? And a lot of that is also, you know, if you don't recognize that sort of pattern in the folks you're working with, the same kind of thing that you can't just tell people, all right, you know, we're going to go agile and we want you to fail fast and, you know, all those great buzzwords. We want you to, you know, to really kind of grab this and self-organize and do that autonomy stuff. Wait, we've only ever done what you've told us to do. Right? So they'll try and they'll fail typically because they're not, you know, someone like myself or probably you, both of you, we don't even need to be told. Whether we're given the permission, we're probably so bold. I mean, I'm one of the benchmarks on our autonomy scale. And I'm like pegged to the left because I don't care. I'm the honey badger, right? I'm gonna do what's right, whether you want it or not. But so many other people, especially in different cultures, are super command and control. I mean, they are beyond our rightmost benchmark for controlling. And that's another factor that I never considered, because it's the same sort of thing. You say something to someone and like a couple of days later, why didn't that land? Why didn't I see a change? Why aren't they taking advantage of? We've just told them, sure, be more agile, be more autonomous, do things on your own. Well, no, they're not capable yet. You know, you have to help almost over exaggerate to help get to, you know, because the mindset has been developed for a long time. It can change, you can grow. But so that's I think one of the biggest things that I've been embarking on over the past year or so with my colleague, and we're doing it with results with clients as well, because it's all about changing the conversations around, you know, like even halfway through a workshop that we were doing with one client, the CEO, we don't, you know, who's not in the workshops, because we want the real people doing the real work, not with some high power, you know, we don't want a lot of power differential in the room.
Yeah.
And, you know, we checked in with him after we pissed off somebody in the group, Turley accidentally said something that was on mic. I said, John, you know, but it turned out to be a wonderful accident. Like, we should repeat that, John. That was really awesome. We got them, we cracked them open. And he said halfway through that the CEO said, I can already see different conversations going on. I can see that the people are acting differently. That was like, you know, only partway through a very short workshop. So it is possible to nudge, you know, move the needle on people and help them, you know, understand these kinds of things and help them work a little more collaboratively and that sort of thing. So that was pretty powerful. And that's kind of, you know, a bit eye-opening to me.
So when I think of agile mindset, a lot of times, people process tools, right, is a really easy one to go after. But I always think we should favor feedback over analysis. And that's usually a good place to start. And because a lot of times people's default is, let's do a bunch of analysis, then we can control what's going to happen. And I guess if I see that, then I'm like, well, shouldn't we take more of a feedback? What experiment can we run? What hypothesis do we have here? What are we trying to solve? And if we can add a little bit more science back into like computer science, I feel like that gets us down that path where you can start to like get that feedback that we're talking about, or get to that agile mindset. I guess that's how I define it or think about it. And I guess I'm curious on your opinion on that.
I think there are some elements like safe experiments that you're maybe brushing up against or talking about. And that is certainly really important, because that helps build sort of the skills at trying things out, getting some feedback, not being afraid to fail. And I like to think of it, you know, almost DevOps-y terms, but I've used this for a while, like, you know, keep the blast radius small.
Yep.
And that way, folks, you know, when I've worked with some junior engineers, maybe we're hashing out some crazy ass architectural, you know, argument or a different pattern. And, you know, like, all right, I'll give you 8 hours to try it out. Or, you know, here's a time box. Go try this experiment. See if it's going to work. I bet it's not. But go ahead and try. And because that's how people learn. And then that builds, you know, that nudges them up a little level. They get a little confidence, and the experiment might work and it might not. And the point is, it's a great way to begin to kind of lure them into a different way of thinking. And that, you know, that kind of humble scientific journey of, there's a hypothesis, right? It's not fact. And, you know, so yeah, I think that's a good approach.
And I think, like you said before, the three of us probably favor action over inaction, but that's not the default for everybody. And so taking that action to write that first line of code or do that first thing or whatever it is maybe our default. But one thing I do, it sounds like a similar workshop to what you were talking about, is I run people usually through like a DISC assessment. And then we talk about it as a team, like where are our defaults? Where do we like to behave? And how does that help us? And how does that hurt us? And a lot of times, I mean, I will say I shouldn't put like, I don't know, blanket statements on, but I will say that a larger majority than not are what we call the C-level, where they're more compliant, they're more analytical, they don't like breaking rules, and they like to follow procedures. And so that's usually a lot of developers tend to be in that way. Like more than majority, I would say, would be in that half. And so that tends to get people that don't want to break the rule. They don't want to take that next step without permission. And so sometimes it's like, no, you can do this. This is part of the new rules of the game. And so if they've always been working in an environment where you don't step outside of your bounds, you wait for someone to tell you what the next task is, not only is that the environment they've grown up in, but that's what their natural tendency is. Maybe the environment affects their natural tendency, and that's where they are, you know, having struggle with it a little bit. But knowing oneself and knowing your natural tendencies can help you then to see those things and then maybe make it a conscious change too. And have your team help you with that as well.
Yeah, and that's something that we also, mostly John Turley, not myself, but he will do dialogue partnering. He'll do coaching with individuals to kind of help recognize your boundaries and kind of the things that might be holding you back. What sort of default position are you at, and where might you want to go? And it's kind of a guided journey, right? He's a guide, not going to tell you how to do it, but going to help see the way to, because you're right. I think in our industry, there is a high degree of command and control, unfortunately, especially it does seem to be in larger enterprises, maybe not Tesla, mm-hmm. but maybe everybody else. I don't know. And it really, I think, is the biggest lever you can push. I mean, I don't know if it's a 50%, like you tweak that, you just nudge the organization and the teams, you just nudge them a little bit. I don't have any metrics to say what it truly can do, but it's a big lever. It's the bigger lever than tools and a bigger lever than process. Mm-hmm. You know, like when you start hearing things like, well, if we just tell them the process more or increase the level of detail of the process, surely things will get better. Now, and my name's not Shirley, but no, they won't. It probably won't. But if you help them change how they view things and begin to take that hypothesis testing more humble, small little steps that we can take safely. And that's it. The leadership management, you know, at any level needs to, the classic support their autonomy, whatever that means, but it does mean giving them the space and the ability to grow and do it safely.
Yeah, I think a lot of times it comes down to those worldviews, and sometimes it's hard to hash those out unless you have that conversation. Like no one ever really asks, hey, John, what's your worldview? Like, how do you think of things from a values and principles standpoint? A lot of times you don't ever actually get to that deep conversation, you know, with a team. Or maybe it comes out in your decision-making. It definitely will. But you don't actually explicitly say that. And I think that can be a valuable thing to talk about. You know, what do you value over other things? And then how would we display that? There was a team that I worked with one time, and they took they kind of came up with this themselves. They took the 12 principles from servant leadership, from Robert Greenleaf's thing, and they did the servant leader of the sprint. And so every sprint they would nominate somebody and said, oh, this person really lives stewardship. You know, they really help promote the team and creating a great environment. And this is how they did this. And they'd write that story and they'd stick it on their team board on the wall. And then that person would have to nominate somebody else the next sprint. And that was just one of the things they did to kick off each of their retros. And I thought that was a pretty cool thing because it just built up all these stories of like how they live their values. I don't know that too many teams do stuff like that, but I think that those are great ways to display your agile mindset or the mindset you have and the values that you hold as a team.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. I've never heard of anything like that. I've heard, you know, I've tried to help teams mix up retros by, you know, giving out the Azure retrospectives book and say, here, you know, who wants to do the next one and pick something, pick a different way to do it and lead us through it. But I like that does sound like a pretty cool approach to let's take something and explore it. And it's a shared journey. And it's, I think it really important to, you know, to me that says number one, the team was given / was willing to take the space to do something. What? We're not producing code. We're not writing, you know, we're not shipping features. Oh my goodness. We're working on ourselves. Oh, how, you know, oh my goodness. Is that, you know, is that allowed? Is man, right. And that, so that's awesome that folks either just did it or someone helped support them to do that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
That's cool.
Yeah. They had a good scrum master that helped them figure that out and like put that in place. But Jeff, wow. You were going to ask something.
Yeah. I was just going to chime in that because this has been coming up a lot, in conversations I've been having, that whole taking the time to do something. And I feel like this is just one of the biggest lies that we tell ourselves in organizations is, oh, we'll get to that later. We'll get to that later. You know, when it's less stressful, when we've got less stuff going on. I'm like, when have you ever in your professional career looked around and been like, man, there's nothing to do this week. I guess we'll just sit around and think about improvement, right? Like the workload is always there. That's in fact why they call it a job, because you know, the job is always there and there's more shit that you have to do. So I feel like we just make that excuse up, like we don't have the time when we've got all of these artificial deadlines and milestones that are being pushed on us. And the other thing to that is it's always, there's coming from a lot of startup experience, I understand the need for speed. I understand the constant balance between runway and improvement, right? Like we need to get something out in order for to make payroll here. But even there has to be some sort of long-term strategic thinking. And to me, what you were both talking about is long-term strategic thinking in the value of our employees, the value of our system, the value of how we literally deliver value versus just getting stuff done today. And somebody has to kind of be able to poke their head up and see that long-term vision. And why I'm kind of hot on this topic right now is one of these tracks that we're trying to get going in my environment is, you know, we want to move a lot faster. And it's like, all right, well, we're just going to put these two people over here on it because they know the most about it. Nobody else really has experience with it. And they're going to go really fast. And it's just like, okay, just understand you're introducing fragility into your system. Okay. You're not willing to expand the knowledge set. So you're creating a silo of knowledge here. Good luck if those two people want to, I don't know, have a vacation or God forbid, get a new job or something like that. We can make these trade-offs, but I don't think we're doing it with visibility into what the actual ramifications of that type of trade-off are. So a little bit of rambling here, but I think it, you know, understanding that this is a long-term investment in your people, like bringing autonomy to them makes them anti-fragile, makes your system more robust, makes it more a better ability to respond to change versus simply fixating on speed and getting something out the door today.
Yeah, it's counterintuitive of ways to increase speed. And I think that's part of the problem because, you know, there are a lot of trade-offs. You're pointing out that, sure, we can put these two folks on it and risk not, you know, like you said, not expanding. Who knows how to do this? And there's always trade-offs for a lot of things we do. And, you know, I was just talking with somebody. I'm just kind of looking at my notes because I was just with a you know, chatting with some folks that were talking about some of their pain points, and there were kind of a what I would say, a challenge for the team to deal with interruptions from leadership with truly, in their mind, critical requests to get something done now. And I think I wrote it down. Leadership wants what they want and when they want it. True. That's a true statement, but you need to also explain, okay, well, we're doing this now for another leadership. There's a trade-off. So you need to understand that, yes, we can drop what we're doing and do this now, but there's a consequence. And a lot of, you know, I think if you help explain trade-offs, consequences, because they have a right to ask for something, but you also, I don't even want to say have a right, have a duty to explain the trade-offs and the, and, you know, the, that particular problem, not only, you know, sometimes it's hard to speak power, you know, to power about things like that. But I said, and then that also tells me that as a team, I would want slack. I'd want to help you take your 13 point stories that are inside your darn sprint. And let's, you know, let's get them down to ones and twos, mm-hmm. you know, help you also be able to recognize this is our world. We're going to deal with it by making things really, really small. And so that when the interruption happens, it could be, yes, I have a sheet of cookies in the oven. It'll be done in about an hour and then I'll get to your stuff. Right. But if it's, oh, I'm partway through a 13 point story and I won't be done for, you know, 3 weeks, leadership's going to, you know, just want to totally throw a fit. So that kind of thing, you know, there's, if it's reality, how do we deal with it? How do we help explain there's trade-offs? Because, you know, it's trying to empathize with legitimate requests, but have them empathize with you, you know, and that's really, it's a two-way street. You know, don't be an order taker and don't be afraid to let management, leadership, business, whoever it is, understand this is what you need to know about our world, you know, so that you're also informed of when you ask us to do this, we're not doing something else. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's fine, but, you know, if you don't share that sort of thing, if you don't share those trade-offs, if you don't have those conversations, I can't blame them. If they just keep asking and the behavior never changes, why would it? Mm-hmm.
I hear another good friend and coach, Chad, in the back of my head. Like whenever I hear this, it's like life is all about trade-offs, all right? It's not right or wrong. It's all about trade-offs, right? And just make those trade-offs transparent to the organization and you're able to make the right decisions. Or ideally, if not necessarily the right decisions, but again, just transparent decisions. We understand the most optimal. We understand what the ramifications are going to be. We understand we're getting this and not that, et cetera. And just... like I said it a few times, but it's just bringing transparency to the discussion, right?
Yeah.
Like without that, how can you expect anybody to make an optimal decision if they don't have the right context?
Right.
You two kind of made me think of this analogy. It's not fully thought out. Maybe you can help me think it out and maybe we can use this. I was thinking of the rule of threes. Have you heard of that with like survival? So like you can go 30 seconds without air, or sorry, 3 minutes without air, obviously unconscious before you die. You can go about 3 hours without an exposure in extreme conditions without shelter, like without clothes or anything like that. Like think like, you know, you're in Alaska in the winter or something like that, you know. You can go 3 days without water. You can go 30 days without food. So what if like delivery is more like the air that you can only go about 3 minutes. And if you're not delivering, you know, organization's probably going to get rid of you, especially if you're in a startup, right? Maybe technical excellence is like that 3 hours where it's like, if you don't have technical excellence, like it's going to catch up to you pretty quick, you know? And maybe the 3 days with the water is like, that's your values of people-centric, like stuff we were talking about before. And then maybe the 30 days, the food is like continuous improvement, strategy, product strategy. Are we going in the right direction? Like that type of stuff. I don't know. Thoughts on that analogy? You guys kind of all like spurred that in my head as we were talking through this. No?
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, that's pretty wild. It's a little dramatic.
Yeah, it made me think about
result in death if we don't do them right. But.
Well, organization death, product death, potentially, right?
Yeah.
Or bankruptcy, absolutely. Yeah. Technical debt can lead to bankruptcy. Yeah, and your competitors eating you for lunch. Yeah.
That's and we've talked about this a few times, but when you were talking about it, it made me think about our conversations we had around delivery metrics versus value metrics, right? Yeah. Like which is more important to an organization? Does it matter how valuable your stuff is if you can never get it out the door? Does it matter if you're really good at getting stuff out the door, but it's just crap that nobody wants, right? So it's like both sides of that equation. I should do a plug here. I just started watching it on YouTube. It's Vicente's new stuff. I think it's Drunk Agile or whatever.
Yeah.
Really cool stuff that he's putting out there. But related to this, it was just talking about, he was talking about WizGIF and cost of delay. And he had some sort of mathematical model where he was proofing out that it didn't matter, right? Like if you just broke down your stuff into items that were less than 1 month in size and just continually focused on the thing that you got done quicker, mathematically you would come out ahead in all of these different equations. And it always gets me jacked up because I love having that conversation. But this is also one of the other things that we're working on internally, which is we've been so focused on initiatives, and these initiatives tend to be like 3 to 6 months in size, and the big bang releases at the end of it. And it's like, hey guys, like what do you think would happen if we just started breaking this stuff down into little bite-sized chunks, right? And so we would go for no longer than a month before we deliver something out to production. And then, you know, if that's the first step, what would happen if it was 3 weeks? What would happen if it's 2 weeks? What, you know, and just continually getting this stuff down, and we're definitely making progress, and we're finally getting to the point where we're like 1 week out, which is great. And we were kind of talking about this earlier. We're starting to roll out the whole TDD, really, really doubling down on unit testing, code coverage, but just how that should be. How sometimes it's negatively viewed, like, oh, I've got to invest time into writing code, or excuse me, writing tests that test my code. That's what we've got testers for. Why would I invest that time into doing this? And so
I want to pause you right there, Jeff. Like, how do you answer that question, John? Because like,
that's what I was going to ask.
Okay.
Oh man, I wanted to talk about the first part too before we. But we can get back to that. But yeah, there's actually some cool things about the initiatives, right? And doing things in size, and like that's a really expensive way to test a hypothesis. So we can get back to that. There's cheaper ways to test hypotheses, and yeah, there's, you know, a lot of times the devil's in the detail, but building it's a really tough way to figure out if we got it right and how much. And that's egotistical as hell. Like that's unless you've got really, really good input from the customers, even so, if I have really, really good input from customers, I bet I can do it smaller. And I bet I can still do it better and cheaper and faster than if you didn't and you're just guessing. Anyway, but yeah, the whole, the technical excellence part in the TDD, and I like to go up to BDD, behavior-driven development. When you kind of have things up and running, And you're already there. For example, I needed to add a feature to my fire planning app. A couple of clients, and this is the sort of thing. Yeah, you know, get some feedback. I'll take it in. You know, I'm kind of curious about it. Like, yeah, it sounds like a cool idea. I get a second similar request. I'm like, yeah, okay. Well, maybe I should do that. There's a couple people. And then I might ask around for, you know, third or fourth opinion about it. I'm like, okay, cool. So you want to be able to control the map type in a PDF. All right. We don't really focus that much on PDFs because ideally you're using it real time. But some people still want to have a printout of their pre-plan with a little map, Google map with their little things on it. And hey, you know, I noticed we get the satellite image, which is cool because you can kind of see the dirt footprint of this thing that we're pre-planning. But I noticed in the PDF, you know, like gave me the road. You know, I was like, true statement. Like I let you control it in one, but not the other. You know, because sometimes I'm lazy like that. I'll like wait till somebody asks. Hell with it, right? Mm-hmm. you know, sure, I could have done it. So I set about to do it. And I also add that to the issue. I add the person's name, who requested, you know, and if there's any tweaks from the different people that request it. So along the way, I kind of have this on the backlog. I'm taking notes. And, you know, because at the end, the closed loop is I send an email to those folks. But so I sit down, I write my cucumber feature, you know, how this is supposed to behave. You know, I should be able to change the PDF type. Of course, it fails right away because there's, you know, there's nothing. There's nothing in the code, right? And then shortly after, you know, I get it from the form, trying to submit to the server. Boom. Of course, there's no attributes. There's nothing. You know, it's dead in the actual server side, so the classes don't have any. All right, let me drop down and do some TDD. Pull up RSpec. Add, you know, I should have this property, but you know, okay, cool. Now I got a little, you know, low level thing pop back up to the BD, you know, to the cucumber test, the acceptance test. Still, you know, try it again. Gets a little further. Oh, no kidding, because I didn't put params in. You know, there's nothing in the controller, right? So, and to make the long story short, the combination of TDD, BDD, kind of tracking what users want. In less than an hour, it was deployed, fully tested, right? I mean, with acceptance tests for my future self, TD, you know, lower level unit tests also for my future self. And did it take me longer to write the test? A little bit, but not a lot, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Starting from scratch, it's a bit of a hurdle, just like it's starting from a blank piece of paper. It's a bit of a hurdle to get that first, you know, come on, how come I can't deploy this, even if it doesn't have anything in it? Get me something rolling so I can deploy this stupid thing, even while we're building it. It's the same. Yeah, there's some hurdles. But boy, once I think of it like a seaplane or a motorboat, you know, you get up on the step. Yeah, there's a lot of drag at first because there's the wetted area is huge. Like you're trying to pull this whole big thing through a lot of stuff we don't know about and dark, you know, things that I haven't done before. But once you've done it and once you feel it and once you taste it, I'm really confident. And I don't have stellar code coverage, and I'm not perfect. You know, I got crap in the code. You know, I've got some pieces that are left over that I should just delete because they're old. You know, so I'm not trying to go for perfection, but I'm just illustrating that the value of being able to do that kind of level of work, I think it's fast because it was boom, 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 boom. So thinking it slows you down initially, it will because it's new, but eventually in a short amount of time, it's a pattern. You learn how to do it. You learn how to do it well. It's just like coding. You follow some patterns and it's like snap, snap, snap. It's not like I have to think really hard about each thing. No, it's just another stupid thing. A lot like, well, at least the way I design things is consistent as hell, right? I you know, why would I have done that property different than any, you know, the other 13 properties that, you know, are there? It's kind of one and the same, mostly because I already had map type available for the regular view. So this is just adding another attribute, passing it into the Google static maps. And right, I mean, it's ding, 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 you know, changing something I had hard coded to say roadmap to now it's taking a variable in from the, you know, initializer. And it's fast. And so I've heard that complaint about won't this slow us down? But the reality is no, it'll speed you up and it'll really speed up your future self. And that's what you need to care about. It's not, unfortunately, we care too much about the here and now. How many story points did I ship and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, but debug later sucks. Do you ever track that? Oh, no, we don't track that. Well, why don't you start tracking that crap? And how about the fact that this kind of simple stuff should be in the developer's realm? And when I'm working with teams, the larger stories will actually bring in the QA, the dev, and the business person to have a conversation about this larger thing that we're going to build, so that QA provides, like, right, I'm a happy path kind of guy. Like, you know, I'm not, you know, testers are mysterious to me because they think totally different than I do. And they're extremely valuable. You know, we developers just think, you know, we know how it's supposed to work. And, you know, a QA person comes in and breaks it in like 3 seconds. So adding that mix in the beginning, and then if you're lucky, you can pair a little bit, help maybe write the cucumber test together, do a little bit of that. And then sure, if you don't want to pair all the time, the developer at least has, because when the cucumber tests pass, I'm done. You know, you can clean it up, you can do some other things, but, you know, it's also the definition of done. Sometimes I put the cucumber, you know, given when thens into the story to help describe these are the different scenarios and this is how I'm kind of thinking of it. And, you know, this is the you know, it's a lot like a range act assert. It's just in a different way. It's given some preconditions. Yeah. When I do this, something happens. And the QA people, you know, what's cool. They can actually go be some freaking QA people instead of doing your damn work, developer, right? Deliver your code tested. Don't make someone else write, you know, don't make someone else learn everything from scratch about the stupid feature and then try to write tests that could be overwritten, right? Sometimes testers go beyond, far beyond what, like, what, why are you testing that? That'll never happen. Well, I don't know. Well, no, that'll never happen the way I've designed the code, right? I mean, so to me, letting testers do tester things like exploratory testing and actually something of value is a side effect of, you know, doing BDD and TDD with the developers.
And this goes back to something you were hitting on last time, which again is just shortening that feedback loop. For non-engineers, I always, especially... Like I work a lot with product owners and project managers and product managers. And it's just like, hey, imagine you wrote a really lengthy email about how things were going and why they were doing it. And, you know, it's a pretty meaty email that you sent off to your boss. And a month later, your boss swings by and goes, hey, so about that email that you sent me, can you give me a little bit more detail about it? That's not going to be fresh in your memory. What the fuck email are you even talking about, right? Let me go open Outlook. Let me find the email. Let me rehash all of that in my head and figure out what was I even talking about it when it was... Okay, that's what your engineers are doing every time you come back to them with a bug, a week, a month, or whatever that time frame is later on. That's all wasting your system, right? So just shorten that feedback loop or eliminate it altogether like you're talking about. The problem is that's hard to measure. Right, it's hard to measure the absence of something unless you're baselining it, like you were talking about, which is okay. Today, how long do we spend going back and fixing bugs or debugging or whatever we have to do, and then we could measure the absence of it later on. But it's hard to measure something that no longer exists afterwards. I think is what it maybe one of the reasons why
people focus the idea on it. About things like BDD, TDD, like. Getting good at story splitting, making things smaller. The metric would be flowing more stories through the system in a given period of time. In theory, that would be the metric. Sure. And if you had the way to show eliminating backwards flow or eliminating post-release bugs, you know, so yeah, some of those other measures that you might want to, you know, you could measure lead time, like if, because all those things, in theory, should help reduce the time it took to get something out the door, and then potentially reduce the what do they call it? The change, the rate of the change defect. Like, if I push something to production and then bugs happen or something like that, right? The change fail rate, whatever they call it. You know, that's measurable. If you're, you know, again, part of this is if you want to measure that kind of stuff, you have to sometimes have actual. You know, maybe Jira issue types or something literally. Yeah, this is, I'm going to track the fact that a bug happened post-release because that's expensive. You know, and other things, do people track when it failed business validation? You know, we thought we were done, you know, we put it on a box and this big, you know, we're doing this little agile stuff, except, you know, little agile development, but then this waterfall testing and then this waterfall of business acceptance. You know, of course, none of that's agile. That kind of feedback that late is so disruptive. I should ask, because it's actually happened in a team we're working with. Do you track that? That's a great question. I need to ask that because that's horrible, right? like, wait, you had this huge upfront process to try to get everything right, you know, and you still got it wrong. Oh, well, you'll never get the time back, right? That, like, to me, I always say this is a triple whammy. You built the wrong thing. You'll never get the time back, and you got to build it again. You know, it's like, it's the worst of the worst. And how to make that go away is to shorten the cycle and to give a sense to the developers. Like, if you have a spidey sense about something that's, you know, this feels a little like, I don't know, I think I'd like to get some feedback from the business person. I guarantee you, they'll be happy to give you feedback. What they're not happy doing is if you, you know, like, I know it's got to be horrible to, I've just, you know, we've just done an 8-week sprint and 200 story points. Now, can you review everything? Mm-hmm. I guess, but that sucks. Right. I mean, so
right.
All those kinds of things just, you know, go away when you turn things into smaller bits of things and try to flow and build some of those tests in from kind of the get go. So you've got automation on, you know, on your side and, you know, all those kind of, you know, it's a fairly holistic approach that I tend to preach, and it's hard for people to conceive that it would work, but it works.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad you're bringing that up, because that was something I wanted to mention last time we were talking about it too. Is, and I'm not beating up on Jira, because I'm sure Azure DevOps does the same thing, but like, everybody starts with to do, doing, and done. And that done column, it really pisses me off. Like, it's very misleading, right? And this is exactly what you were talking about, is there needs to be a validation step in there. And we just throw it right into the done so that we can move on to the next thing, right? And for the workflows that we've been creating, like, everything has a validation step inside of it. So it's not done when the engineers release it to production, right? That's the validation step. That's the step where the product owner, the product manager, whoever, right? Somebody needs to be going in there and saying, we had a hypothesis. Is this actually influencing our numbers? Is it, you know, we're big on ARPU, revenue per user, or AUM, assets under management, right? Like, those are our attributes that we're going after. And if we're thinking that this feature is going to affect our assets under management, well, we need to actually validate that, because what do we know what success is? I feel like I beat a dead horse with this all the time. But I feel like when I'm in these sessions with people, I say, all right, great, jump in the DeLorean, and we're 6 months from today. We did all of this work that's on this roadmap, but none of these metrics moved. Are we going to be celebrating success in that instance? Mm-hmm. Fuck no, we're not. We're going to be pissed that we just wasted 6 months worth of run rate, right? So it is more about the metrics, and we have to have some sort of validation step inside of there. It's not about the work. The work is just what's going to help get us to that point, but it is about the metrics or the outcomes, like you were talking about last time, right? It is about achieving those outcomes. That is what success means. And it's just, man, I get all fired up about this. But if we don't clearly understand what success is even going to be or what the outcome is going to be, like, we haven't done the due diligence on our part to even get started with the work.
Yeah, and that's really important. And again, I can't overemphasize, you know, finding the cheapest way to validate your hypotheses and building it is not it. And, you know, you better be damn sure that you've gotten as much input as you have along the way, and you're building maybe half of what you think you need to build. And I think I explained last time that, you know, like, as I built a silly ass library with zero ability to have folders, right? It's a single stack. You walk in, there's just a pile of books everywhere. We know that's the stupidest library ever. But it had the basics. You could upload, you could search, and, you know, you could see number of downloads and crap like that. But the point was, I just used that to illustrate the absurdity to which sometimes I go. And that was with a good client, right? And it was, the blast radius was small, and they knew kind of what the design looked like, but I put that out there first. You know, so it was a private release and get some quick feedback. But it's, you know, take it to an extreme to try to figure out, so you're not faced with 6 months of work and like, wow, the needle's not moving. Crap. Did we build the wrong thing? Are we not measuring it? Didn't we market it? You know, who knows what it could be, but it's really, there's a lot riding on something that's even more important that you sneak up. I like to use, you know, sneak up on the answer. It's might take guts to put less out there. And, you know, some people will argue, well, no, you know, this is the, you know, the iPhone. You don't put half an iPhone out there, right? I mean, this is, we're going to change the world. This is such an awesome thing. Okay. Well, that's a big bet to be taking. You know, that's cool. If you're willing to risk all that, and if you got some reasons why you think we're okay, that's fine. But really kind of force that. And as I said, the sort of along the side of doing this sort of thing, I pre-bake into the system ways to actually track metrics. That's a line of code in the feature, you know, that either it's when a button got clicked, you know, something got used or whatever kind of metric, like, oh, cool, somebody actually used this really awesome feature. And I even threw it, you know, I'm tailing the server logs, and I got, you know, things to track and put special things in there. Like when this thing happens, and I'll write a rule, boom, send it into the Slack channel, like, woo, somebody used the feature, pop the champagne. I think I even put one of the Slack messages, you know, but that was after a lot of going back and forth with the clients, and even with their, you know, it was a distributor thing. It was actually a pretty powerful feature. You know, super awesome. And that was a lot of work to make sure we had it right before we, you know, truly built it. And, but even when we built it, it was still, I hope they weren't blowing smoke, because, you know, and being able to actually see it used and then see it tracking on our little tracker. So stuff like that really lets people know you're serious about out measuring. You know, not only do we care about outcomes and we try to design for it and we try to see if we can produce less to generate some, outcomes, and we actually built something to track it automatically, you know, like we have a little API there, so that, you know, that's how much I cared about tracking outcomes. And I think that's important.
I think it's interesting. I was just thinking, man, it seems like we've talked about almost all the sources of waste. You know, Lean has there like 8 sources of waste. You know, we've talked about not utilizing talent, like for testers, like why are they doing the monotonous tasks? We should have the BDD in place for that. We talked about inventory, like wait queues inside of organizations, like get the pings passed around last time, and overproduction here, right? Like, how do we know that we're not just producing more features to solve the same problem? We might've already solved it like months ago, and we just haven't released all that stuff, right? And defects, and we've talked about that. So I don't know, just something that I was thinking about, like all the things we come back to, like are things we probably have known for a very long time or been written about. You just got to apply them in your context every day and think about how are we moving away from, you know, things that maybe we've known for a long period of time and reflect on those things. So if you don't spend that time continuously improving and reflecting on that, you're probably, I don't know, destined to go down the same path, you know?
That's a great point. Yeah, that's, I didn't even think about it like that, but you're right. Those are all easily relatable to waste. Yeah, great point. Yeah.
You've said it a few times now, John, and I really feel like it is worth being super explicit about. And I don't know, maybe it's just built into your mindset at this point, but you keep bringing up that humble mindset, right? And like sneaking up on the solution, I think you said. But that's another big thing. And I don't mean to pick on the place that I'm at right now, but in a more general sense, like I oftentimes deal with or experience with people that they feel like they know the problem, they know their customer, they've done the user research, and that justifies the big thing that they want to put out there. And sure, there's a certain amount of validity to that. But just remember, by and large, even that user research is on something that your customer can't yet purchase from you yet. I think it's Marty Kagan talked about this in his book Inspired, where it was like, even where he was recommending something like, if you're going to do like user research, actually offer the opportunity for them to buy the feature in the research, right? Because all too often, even when you're doing research and a customer tell you they want something, yeah, I would totally buy that thing. Great. How much, like, I'll give you the chance to buy it right now. It'll be ready in a month or two when we build it. But like, there's such a big difference between a customer telling you they want something and them actually offering money in exchange for the thing that you just built. And if you start with that humble mindset of, well, we think this might solve our problem, we think this is going to generate money, like right away you start thinking about that differently versus, oh, we just need to get it out there and this is going to be the big million-dollar idea, right? Like one sounds like a gamble, one sounds like a risk, the other sounds like a sure thing. And there, I mean, by and large, there are no sure things. Don't treat your product like a sure thing. Again, you've just said it so many times, and I just really wanted to be explicit about that. There is a humble mindset that you should approach solving problems with for your customers.
Yeah, and I think the reason I harp on that is because, you know, there, we have a lot of experts in our industry. You know, the expert mindset is, you know, is their ego is built on knowing it all, and you know, so it's hard to sometimes to put that ego aside a little bit and you know, challenge yourselves to think about it. I might be right. I was damn sure. I mean, I could have guaranteed you the full library production system that we ended up building, that I was very sure that it was correct. I still didn't build it all right away. Like, so there's other reasons to think about. You have to have all of it? How do you know? Like, really? And the devil's in the details. So, you know, sometimes it's really about, let's see what your mock-ups look like. And, you know, a lot of times you might mock something up that's big and cool and, you know, really awesome. But even development, a lot of times, you know, I'll chop it into pieces and do certain slices of it and different parts of it and kind of stage it and then get some of that out the door. So, you know, wouldn't you rather get some feedback sooner? Wouldn't you rather get something out the door and you know, whether you're able, again, it depends on your industry and then all this other crap. But, you know, most of the experience that I've had, I've been able to do this time and time again, where I can get something out the door at a certain level and begin, because I always tell business people, we're digging a hole. We'll build you whatever you want, but while we're doing it, we're just digging a hole, spending your money, and you're not filling it back in. Right? The hole is just getting deeper. And yeah, well, we can't release this awesome, most world's awesome insurance portal thing that we built. I super thought it was really cool. Yeah, we can't release it until all four product lines are translated into this. I'm like, really? When do you ever sell all four at once? Never. Okay. How about we just do, because we were actually ready to release, you know, with the first product line that had gotten finally translated, and they were reluctant. And so, you know, a silly me goes into the CEO and kind of the product marketing man and say, come on, what's your biggest product? Let's just do that first. And then we'll get the other ones along the way, but at least we'll start getting some feedback. And they did it. And they got $1 million in like the first quarter. You know, meanwhile, they started translating the other ones. And it's like, they were ready to not do that so that they, you know, we were sure we needed to have them all. Really? So, you know, it can really mean money. It can mean learning. It's so egotistical to think that you know it all and that even you're with the best of your ability, you got all the right answers from the customers that you know, because sometimes they'll tell you what they know you want to hear. And it's a skill even there. To try to get them to, you know, not quite buy, but like, really, no, give it to me for real. Don't tell me what I want to hear. So, but the point is, be a little more skeptical, be a little more humble, treat things like a hypothesis, not a sure thing. It's not fact, you know, you're trying to paint a future picture. So take it as a challenge to what's the least we can do to try to get some return on our investment, because that should be rewarded. Not we built everything and look at that, 80% of the features were never used. Wow, woohoo, way to go. And the 20% are great. Yeah, well, you still wasted 80% of, you know, 80% of the features is a waste. You could have not built those and been happy. So anyway, that, you know, it's try a different angle sometimes, but you're dealing with people who you know, and also sometimes organizations only give you one shot. We got one shot to do it. Better pack everything into it, because God forbid we have to go back to the front of the process and ask for some enhancements and get it through the stupid review board, right? So sometimes there's other weird things that cause this goofy behavior that has nothing to do with Well, there's logic on somebody's. Somebody thinks it's valuable to do it that way. But yeah, so, you know, dig a little bit. But yeah, I mean, to me, the fun part is watch how little I can deliver to get some feedback and to get some money. That should be your goal. Like, oh, cool. Maybe we'll just leave it like this for a while until people ask for more. Like, and it takes guts to be like that. And you know, so that, I don't know. Yeah. I hope that helped.
It was really cool hearing that story. Jeff's got this really great story that he does as an analogy, and it's basically your story, but he like spells it out. Like, I don't know, Jeff, you want to go through it now, but like, you know what I'm talking about? The books one? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't think it's worth necessarily going into because I think I've done it before, but as you were talking through it, that literally that same thing was running through my head. It's like, we keep coming back to shortening those feedback loops, right? You want to shorten the feedback loop to get something out. By doing that, you're going to maximize your business value. You're going to minimize your risk. You're going to minimize your time to market. In other words, your cost of delay. These are all great reasons to do that. You're going to maximize your learning, right? And all you did was take a bite-sized chunk out of this giant thing that you're trying to put out, right? It just, man, it boggles my mind that this isn't second nature to I shouldn't say second nature, but this doesn't intuitively make sense.
So we just need to all work together. Everything.
Yeah.
We just need to find something awesome to go build and show everybody how to do it. Yeah.
I know. I think every agile person has that in their head, right? Yeah. For better or worse. But one of the pieces of resistance that I get to that, and I'd love to hear how you approach it, is, well, then our app's just going to be some Frankenstein mismatch, right? There's no cohesive design to it. There's no cohesive experience to it. You know, which, okay, maybe there's some validity to that statement, but like, what would your response to that be, John?
Show me, number one. Okay, like, let me see what you mean. Yeah, so it's not about doing something, you know, like, I guess I take issue with that hypothetical being the only obvious result of doing less. Like, no, like I've never done anything that came across like that when I help shorten it and try to put some, it's, you know, I don't want to say it's like the Mona Lisa paint by number, right? You know, you can still see it's like, oh, there's a Mona Lisa coming. Cool. You know, I don't even know if that's a good analogy. But the point is that we built something that should be cohesive, should be part of the app, you know, should look a lot like it should share the same stupid style sheets, right? It shouldn't look like a Frankenstein. Like, who the hell designed that? Like, yeah, so to me, saying that is like, I'll just throw the bullshit flag out. Like, what? Well, why would you do that? No, we're not saying do such a half-assed job then put something out there that's dumb. No, we're just saying think a little more critically about, like, the library example. I know exact, you know, like what it's going to be when it's full, when it's grown up, but I'm going to put the baby out there and the baby still has some value and it actually shows pieces working and it's in a small blast rate, right? You know, like every context is going to maybe have a different angle to that library thing. But, you know, if that was the only app, okay. I might change my mind, but if it's an, you know, anyway, I you can always make up stories to straw man. I do not like straw man arguments.
I feel like you hit the nail on the head there.
And you get to paint a straw man argument and then shoot it down. All right, give me a break. Grow up.
I feel like you hit the nail on the head there with people, and I'm not trying to beat anybody up, but I think this is a valid statement for people that have been burned by this in the past, is when somebody says iterative, they think crappy, quick version of the whole thing. Right. There is a time and a place for a crappy quick version to be out there. But I feel like a lot of people have bastardized or hijacked that iterative model. And they just say, oh, this is just quick and dirty time and time and time and time again. And again, there's a time and a place for quick and dirty. Right. Not to say, again, we're not being binary here, but that's not what iterative means. Iterative just means the thing that we are releasing is good to go. Right.
Yeah.
Whatever our production quality standard is, that's adhered to.
Right. And you can incrementally grow it. That's the other, you know, axis of growing it, right? Like each iteration, you can grow it along certain levels that you're getting, you know, like either it's a natural evolution, you're getting feedback that says this direction is better than that direction. Yeah. So you can, and that's what a lot of people, as I said, sometimes I have seen organizations that think you get one shot. No, I'm going to do version 0.1 of this library, you know, and that's what I'm releasing. And I'm humble enough to say it's 0.1. And I'm going to keep, you know, I have ideas, but I don't want to just blurt them all out there. I want to, you know, grow with it and get some feedback, get some, you know, better direction, and then do stuff that, and a lot of times I'll architect for that future without being over-architected, but, you know, kind of have a sense of where it's likely to go because I know enough about it, but I'm not going to commit. I'm not going to, you know, it's that kind of resisting going further. So yeah, it's incremental. You can keep improving it. And you know, that's the other thing I think people, I don't know. That's why it's software. So we didn't have to build a freaking mold and then, you know, get like a giant machine and stamp it out, and to change it, it's really expensive. No, that's called car manufacturing hardware, unless you're Tesla.
Right. It's like this pattern of quarantining, going in different directions as you're innovating. Once you figure out what pattern works really well, then you should align on that pattern, maybe bring things back together and combine them, and then you'll find other things you want to iterate on and combine, right? Like that's a very common thing. And you talked about it earlier with your coding. It's like, yeah, I have a pattern. I'm going to go through this thing repeatedly. And you wouldn't just like change everything up because that'd make things very complex for you. So you wouldn't do that. But maybe when you started it, you tried it two different ways because you weren't sure which one was going to work better. And so you might try something and be like, oh yeah, the third one I tried was way better. I'm going to refactor those two when I get to them, you know, to be that.
And you said the magic words, right? So be consistent. Even I'd rather be consistently mediocre. And if I find that third way is awesome, then you damn well better go fix the other two. And so now they're all the same. And a lot of people forget that too. And they just keep moving on. And then pretty soon you got the Frankenstein. Because now you got like, why does that part of the UI look different? How come when I wrote a cucumber test against two menus that look the same on two different kinds of parts of the app, why don't they work the same? For God's sake. Oh, two different teams built it. Oh my goodness. Right. Let's talk about Frankenstein. That's Frankenstein. Right? And it's under the covers and it's horrible. And
when you find that,
I was just going to say, testing has the added advantage. If your crap's hard to test, it's probably crap.
So if you find that, that's okay.
Yeah, sorry.
I was going to say, and if you find that, then that's okay. Let's just refactor it. Like things are going to happen. Like don't slow down and don't deliver anything because we have to think, you know, check every, you know, dot every I and cross every T before we even think about releasing. Like that slowness, who knows if the feature you're even going to release is going to solve the problem. If it doesn't, you might be back in that already anyway or doing something else. So like don't let it slow you down, but then refactor when you find things are different and you find better ways. So yeah, I think people see that as waste, and I see that as experimentation. You're not always going to be 100% right in everything you do. You have to try stuff. And maybe that's just a mentality, too. Maybe we could add that one. Try stuff over, like, try to plan stuff. I don't know. Like, that's
that
could be another item to the manifesto.
Yeah. So, John, as we're kind of wrapping this up, anything you'd like to plug? We didn't really give you an opportunity last time. Anything you want to give a shout out for, promote for our listeners?
You know, if folks are interested in the mindset, and you know, if that piques your interest about how to do some of this developmental journey stuff, you can find me and you know, my colleague John Turley and us, you know, we're at adaptivist.com.
Thank you for listening to the Agile Wire. We are consistently inspecting and adapting ourselves. We would appreciate feedback at feedback@theagilewire.com or on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play Store. See you next time.